This IA audio tape is a recording of an Institute of Economic Affairs occasional lecture in which the role of futures markets is discussed. The speakers are Paul Knapp, president of the Mid-America Institute in Chicago, home to the world's largest futures exchange, and Daniel Hodson, chief executive officer of LIFE, London's financial futures exchange. Mr. Knapp begins with a useful review of the different types of futures contracts which are now available in markets throughout the world. He then goes on to consider how the existence of these instruments have a bearing on public policy.
The most common kind of transaction that we're all familiar with in the futures world is called a cash transaction or a spot market transaction. That is a purchase of a commodity or some kind of corn or metal or bonds. It's a purchase for cash of some specific number of units of a commodity for cash at this particular point in time. It's a cash current transaction. That's called a cash or spot market transaction. Another type of transaction that's been around for a long time, still is what's called a forward transaction. A forward transaction is an agreement between two parties to execute a transaction for the sale of some commodity or good, a specified quality of good, a specified quantity of good at a specified price, but that transaction is going to take place sometime in the future, not today. So it's a contract that's done today for execution sometime in the future. Those forward contracts are individual specialized contracts that are done on a case-by-case basis. A futures contract is very similar to a forward contract. It is a contract in which two parties enter into an agreement that some commodity, agreed upon commodity of a given quantity, of a given quality, will be sold at a given price at some time in the future, very similar to a forward contract. The primary difference for our purposes of a futures contract, though, is that futures contracts are sold on organized futures exchanges. As a general rule, that is a kind of a definitional matter, at least for the purposes of our talk, that the futures contracts are ones that are sold on an organized exchange. The advantage of selling these contracts through an exchange rather than on a case-by-case individual basis is that the product can be standardized. So a futures contract is a standardized contract, whether it's for corn or aluminum or government bonds. It covers a specified number of units, a specified quality of units. So it's a standardized product, standardized contract. Another critical issue is when you buy or sell a contract on a futures exchange, you do not have to worry about who is ultimately on the other side of that contract. One of the important characteristics of a futures contract, it is not executed today. It's executed a month from now or 2 months from now or 5 months from now, depending upon the individual contract. So one of the things a party entering into a contract may have to be concerned about is whether the other side to that contract, the counterparty as they're called, are going to be there to actually execute that contract when the time comes. If you execute a futures contract through an organized futures exchange, you do not worry about that. Through the mechanism of the exchange, there is a guarantee to the other side of the contract. So you buy and sell through the exchange. You may never know who's on the other side of that contract, and you never care. In essence, the exchange will guarantee that contract. The exchange also assures that there'll be an active liquid market for these contracts. So you can go into the exchange through your broker anytime when the exchange is open, any business hours, and you can execute these contracts. So there will always be a market for those contracts, another advantage of an exchange. And a fourth advantage of an exchange is that exchanges provide the mechanism to attract capital into the market. It provides a mechanism where those parties, in addition to those who have an economic interest in the particular contract, those who have capital to invest in that market, to participate in that market, come together through the exchange. And the exchange thereby is a mechanism to draw capital into various markets. Organized futures exchanges have been around for nearly 150 years. I think the first organized exchange, if I'm not mistaken, was the Chicago Board Options Exchange, which was started in 1848. Historically, the first exchanges, and for many, many years, the futures exchanges essentially dealt with agricultural commodities and metals. And for many, many decades, in essence, that's what the future markets were all about. An individual futures product has an essential character which will kind of carry through my comments, and it's something particularly worth paying attention to. The essential character of a futures contract is that it provides a mechanism to protect against adverse price movements. So if for whatever reason, we'll talk about you're a farmer and you're growing corn, and you're concerned about what the market will be, market price for corn will be when you're going to harvest the corn, that's quite a few months from now. You know what your costs are going to be, but you don't know what the market's going to be. You can, in essence, sell your corn crop in the futures market. Sell it in advance. Sell it when you understand what your cost structure is. You don't know what the market's going to be 6 months from now, but you can sell your corn crop through the futures market that way, and in essence assure yourself of what the sales price will be for your crop. So it's an essential mechanism to protect against adverse price developments in whatever commodity you're dealing with. In that case, the particular corn farmer is concerned about prices falling, so he enters into the futures market to protect himself against falling prices. Another party, maybe the processor of corn, the person who has to buy corn to make corn flakes or something, he's concerned about rising prices of corn. He may be entering into long-term delivery contracts for his product, for his processed goods. That processor's concern is just the reverse of the farmer's. The processor's concerned about raising prices. That processor can also go into the futures market and, in essence, be on another side of that same kind of contract. That processor can assure himself that if prices rise, he's going to be protected from loss resulting from that price change. Fundamental of that is worth keeping in mind is if you sell through the futures market, sell a commodity through a futures market, you will make money if the price declines. So you are protected against price declines if you sell into the futures market. If you buy in the futures market, you'll make money if the prices increase. That's then the essential character of the futures contract themselves, is they provide a mechanism to protect against price fluctuation and price risk. The futures market itself, the exchange market for futures, does some things that we already discussed. It establishes a marketplace where these transactions can be executed, which is essential, central marketplace. By being there and by providing the traders and the participants in the market, the exchanges provide the liquidity that make that market work, so that anybody who wants to enter that market can enter that market when they choose to and be assured that there will be somebody there to execute contracts. And it introduces new capital into the market. So those are the essential elements of the futures market that are critical to the issues we'll get to about how the futures products and futures markets contribute to policy solutions. Managing price risk and developing a market and bringing capital to that market. One point that I may add that is worth noting, but is that relatively few of these contracts are actually settled by the delivery, for instance, of the corn, of the actual corn itself. The contracts, while they make money over the time that the prices are fluctuating, the participants in the market will typically sell the contracts on a cash basis before they mature and will not actually take or make delivery on the commodity itself. That's important to the participants, but it's not terribly important to the particular understanding of the issues. There's been a great deal of growth over the last 20 years in the futures market. The primary growth has occurred not so much in the agricultural and metal markets that have been the historic element of futures markets, but more in financial futures market and in energy futures. Financial futures had their origin in the early 1970s when the Bretton Woods fixed exchange rate mechanism, in fact, was disbanded. And at that point in time, there was no longer the opportunity to assure in international commerce that the relationship between currencies would remain stable. In fact, they became unstable and subject to change. Currency futures were the first financial future contract that was introduced at that time, and it would enable, just like it had with corn, it would enable somebody who had an exposure to price changes in a foreign currency to actually enter into a futures contract to buy or sell that currency at a set price today for future delivery, so that if you were concerned about receipt of Japanese yen for a contract you had entered into, but you have to perform the contract and you have to incur the cost today, but you're not going to receive the yen for 6 months until the contract is concluded, you're concerned about what the value of the yen will be 6 months from now, you can enter into a currency futures contract to provide you the assurance of what that price level on the yen will be. Other major financial futures contracts that have been developed over this 20-year period, a very important one is stock index futures. In essence, stock indexes, which you're probably all familiar with, Financial Times Stock Index, Standard & Poor's Stock Index, those stock indexes rise and fall as the value of the stocks rise and fall. There are futures contracts in which you can, in essence, assure yourself of protection against either an unexpected rise in the level of a stock index or a decline in a stock index. So if for some reason you have an exposure to the stock market in a concern of either it going up or down, stock index futures provide you a way of managing that price risk. Third major financial futures contract is government bonds. The essence of government bonds are that they are an interest rate product, and the price of bonds rises or falls as interest rates rise or fall. So if you have an exposure on either side, either you're concerned about interest rates going up, you're concerned about interest rates going down, whatever your particular business or financial exposure might be, the government bond futures markets offers you an opportunity to assure yourself of stability in your exposure to interest rates through participation in that government bond futures market. Energy futures has been another area where there's been significant growth as energy and petroleum has become increasingly critically important. The International Petroleum Exchange here in London, there's a couple representatives here from the International Petroleum Exchange, has been a very active and growing participant in the energy futures market. Those products are essentially futures contracts that are based on crude oil or refined oil products and also natural gas. And again, if you have any exposure to fluctuating prices in oil, oil futures contracts give you a way to manage that risk and exposure. One of the there's been some very rapid growth in the number of futures exchanges around the world. Most of the new exchanges that have developed in recent years have been focused on financial futures products, and the origin of these exchanges tend to be nationalistic interests. Individual countries and economies and financial institutions in those countries are finding increasingly the great value to be offered by financial futures, currency futures, and interest rate-based futures and stock index futures. And typically, individual countries would like to have the markets within their country to deal with the financial futures that relate to their economy. So Spain is an example of a country that has initiated a financial futures market to deal in Spanish government bond futures, stock index futures for Spain, currency futures related to the peseta. So there have been a significant number of new futures exchanges started around the world, essentially oriented to these financial futures. The Futures and Options World Directory of Exchanges for 1993 shows that there's now a total of 75 futures exchanges around the world. And I'm not sure what the historic number is, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's double the number that there were as little as 10 years ago, and maybe even more than that. Some interesting facts about these exchanges. Of the top 10 futures exchanges in the world, and this is ranking them by the volume of futures contracts traded on the exchanges, three of those top 10 are in the United States, three of them are in Europe, two of those three are here in the United Kingdom. London International Financial Futures Exchange, which Daniel Hobson is chief executive of, is the third largest exchange in the world. London Metal Exchange here in London is also one of the top 10, and Matif in Paris is in the top 10. There are two of the top 10 in Japan, one in Australia, and one in Brazil. An interesting point is Life, which is the third largest exchange in the world after exchanges have been here for 150 years. Life was formed only 11 years ago and is now the third largest exchange in the world. Matif in Paris was formed in 1985, so just 8 years ago. It's now the fourth largest exchange in the world. So these exchanges are growing very rapidly, and they're primarily growing on the basis of the financial futures. Of the 25 most actively traded contracts in 1992, and again, remember that up until the early 70s, there were essentially only agricultural and metals contracts. In 1992, of the 25 largest contracts, 19 of them were financial futures contracts. The others of the other six, the fourth largest contract was a crude oil contract, 17th, so it falls way down to the end of the list pretty fast. 17th was a corn contract, 20th a soybean contract, 21st aluminum contract, 23rd largest is a heating oil contract, and 25th largest were red bean futures. But essentially, financial futures are increasingly dominating this market. And again, the financial futures are currencies, stock index futures, and government bonds primarily. There are five futures exchanges housed in London. Life, which I've mentioned a couple of times, is the largest. International Petroleum Exchange is the second largest energy exchange in the world and very rapidly growing. London Metal Exchange trades metal futures. It's the seventh largest exchange in the world. London Fox Futures Exchange trades agricultural futures products, and OM London Exchange, which is an electronic exchange, trades financial futures contracts. So that's kind of a primer and background on futures and how they work and essentially what they bring. I'm going to talk a little bit about the macroeconomic contributions, how futures markets and futures contracts help solve some fundamental macro problems. One of the fundamental macroeconomic problems that all economies and countries face is how to improve economic performance. Futures, by their very nature, assist in improving economic performance. What we've talked about, the futures contracts themselves provide a way to manage price risk, to hedge against changes in price risk, and to assure yourself more stability in your commercial and financial transactions. By getting better control of financial risks, of price risks, you lower the overall risk of conducting business. Lowering risk also enables you to reduce prices of your commodities and of your business. Lower risk, improved prices, improves commerce, improves trade, and as a result, improves economic performance. So futures markets make a fundamental contribution to improving economic performance. The exchanges themselves, which are an essential part of that, we've talked about what the exchanges contribute, creating markets, providing liquidity, and one of the key things it does is provide the mechanism to bring capital into these markets. Capital comes into the markets through the floor traders who participate on futures exchanges, through trading firms that are active in the market, through individual and institutional investors who come into the market, and increasingly through pooled investment programs where individuals and institutions can invest and manage commodities pools. All those mechanisms bring capital into the market and enable the commerce related to these futures markets to function more effectively. So bringing capital into the markets and improving economic performance through reducing risk are fundamental macroeconomic contributions of futures markets. Four very specific problems that I'll cover, problems and how the futures markets aid in solving these problems. The first is one we've talked a little bit about, a problem of how do you conduct international commerce in multiple currencies when very often the cash flow related to those transactions is delayed. You enter into a contract today for delivery of yen or U.S. dollars or French francs. You're not going to get that money for some period of time. The change in the interest in the currency relationships over that period of time, under some circumstances, that change can be enough to destroy your profit margin in a contract if the value of the yen decreases significantly over that period of time. So that's a fundamental problem, how to deal internationally in commerce with fluctuating currency rates. The solution, of course, as we've mentioned, is currency futures. Currency futures provide the mechanism to assure yourself stability in the cash flows and the money that you're going to receive in international commerce. Problem number two, very specific and energy-related problem. The state of Texas in the United States is heavily dependent upon tax revenue that comes from crude oil that is produced in the state of Texas. Its revenue happens to be determined, its tax revenue, as a percentage of the price at which crude oil is sold when it's produced in Texas. That means that the state of Texas puts together its budget. It assumes that oil is going to be produced at the state at some level, which they can predict pretty reasonably. But then they also have to assume what the price of oil is going to be, and then they compute the tax revenue off which the state of Texas is going to run based on their assumed price. They're at great risk then if the price of oil declines. In fact, in 1986, the state of Texas had a real disaster. The price of oil declined from $25.81 a barrel to $11.36 a barrel in that year. That's a 56% decline in the price of oil, which meant a 56% decline in the tax revenue to the state of Texas, a fundamental public policy problem for the state of Texas. The way in which they are solving that problem is they in essence have a price risk, and they are dealing with that price risk through participation in the energy futures markets. They are protecting themselves against a decline in the price of oil and therefore a decline in their tax revenue through participation in the oil futures market. I don't know if there's any connection here, but Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who is the treasurer of the state of Texas and implemented that program, has now gone on. She recently won an election to a seat in the United States Senate, replacing Senator Benson, who is now the Secretary of Treasury of the United States. But it's an important point that she has made in regards to that program. It goes back to my original comments about futures markets, and they're a fundamental economic contributor. They're not essentially a mechanism for risk-taking. Her point is, and this is a quote, she says, the purpose of our program is not to make money or to take chances. The purpose of our program is to create an insurance policy. And in essence, that's what the futures markets enable them to do, in essence, to buy an insurance policy that if oil prices decline, they're going to be protected. They will get their revenue, in essence, that they will lose, they may lose from the decline in oil prices and taxes. They will gain that back through participation in the futures market. Problem number three, how to reduce government expenses for farm price supports. This is a problem in the United States. It's a problem in many European countries. It's a problem around the world. It's very common for governments to pay farmers some amount to make up the difference between actual market prices of their crops and what the government determines to be a reasonable price for those crops to enable the farmer to recover his costs and realize a reasonable return on his investment. Essentially, all countries that are involved in farm price support programs are looking for ways to eliminate their exposure to that. A pilot program has been initiated in the United States under which farmers are being taught and assisted in participating in the agricultural futures markets to assure themselves price stability rather than realizing being paid payments directly by the government. In a pilot program that's in effect this year, the government is teaching farmers how to use the futures market and providing them the money that's necessary for them to enter into transactions in the futures market. The farmers oversubscribe the program. They're quite interested in it, in this test program. It's been enthusiastically received. They will get, in essence, the same level of price support that they would have gotten through the old government program, and it's being done at a lower cost to the government than just passing out price supports. So hopefully we'll see it as a test program, but it's got all signs that that's going to be a successful use of the futures markets to solve a public policy problem. Problem number four, this is something an issue that is very familiar to those of you here in London, how to maintain an insurance market for catastrophic property losses, such things as hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, earthquakes. It's almost in the news daily about the disaster at Lloyd's. The insurance markets in the world are shrinking as those who are providing the insurance coverage in the capital of that market are losing money hand over fist and withdrawing. The question is how to maintain those markets, how to stabilize the risk exposure for those who are participating in that market, and how to attract capital. An innovative new program has been initiated by the Chicago Board of Trade in that regard, and they have initiated and introduced catastrophic insurance futures contracts. Again, an exposure to a catastrophic insurance loss is just in the nature of a price fluctuation. The level of catastrophic losses rises or falls, and if it rises, somebody's got a significant exposure. Catastrophic insurance contracts, futures contracts, have been initiated to enable insurance companies and others who are exposed to losses from insurance catastrophes to enter that market to protect themselves against loss from that price change risk. That's an early program that's just been kicked off, and I guess the jury is still out in terms of how effective that's going to be, but it's an innovative approach to solving essentially a public policy problem and issue through the use of futures markets. Some of these examples that I've covered are, they get a little bit complex in how you actually enter into the transactions to execute the protection, but the fundamental characteristics are the same throughout. It's in essence, when changes in price levels are a potential risk or a problem, the futures markets, if there's a futures market related to the price risk to which you're exposed, that futures market can be used to hedge your risk, to protect yourself from financial loss as a result of those price changes. The futures markets are a mechanism to stabilize and manage that price risk, and the exchanges themselves offer the markets, they provide the liquidity, and they provide the mechanism to bring new capital into these essential commercial enterprises. So my view is, and hopefully I've made somewhat of a case, that economic performance is strengthened by the existence of futures markets, and individual public policy problems and business problems are susceptible to help and solution through the futures markets. Thank you.
Well, I have the short straw here because, of course, I didn't know what Paul was going to say, so I've been hastily making notes and wondering what I myself should say. I think what I should start by doing is just filling in a little bit more about life, because I think that it's not often appreciated amongst audiences like this what the economic significance of our exchange is, and indeed, of course, of the IP and the LME as well. I think the most staggering statistic that I can produce for you is that the daily turnover on life approaches £100 billion a day. In a year, that is £25 trillion, using an American trillion. It's interesting to compare that with what is reckoned to be the outstanding, what's called open interest, the outstanding position in relation to both exchange trade and OTC, and I'll refer to that a little bit later, what are called over-the-counter market derivatives, and again I'll come back to the term derivative, which is about $9 trillion. So you can see that the size of the exchange is absolutely staggering. It's also worth saying that we employ about 2,000 people on the floor alone of our exchange. Come and see it, and you'd be welcome to come and see it. Just get in contact with me. I'd love to take you around. There are 2,000 people on that floor, and there's reckoned to be between 20,000 and 30,000 people involved in the derivatives industry one way or another in London. So it's a tremendous economic importance to the City of London. Invisible earnings, difficult to say, certainly in excess of £100 million a year. And just to put that in the context of our stock exchange here, our equity products alone, which are give or take 10 to 12% of the volume on life, equity derivative products, are actually 1.5 times the volume on the stock exchange. So you can see that in comparative terms, the London Stock Exchange is very small indeed. Now, in comparative terms, of course, they're very important, naturally. The other thing I think to say is to introduce a word which I referred to and Paul didn't, which is the word derivative. Derivatives are essentially both futures in relation to a cash market product and also options. And there are other derivatives like swaps, where the classic form of swap is where you swap an obligation to pay a fixed rate on a loan for a floating rate. That's a form of swap. And all these things are called derivatives. So if I use the word derivative, I'm talking about a slightly broader definition. I think it's also worth saying, and I myself am very much aware of this, that the derivative market as a whole has really sprung into importance very much over the last 10 years. I've been involved in corporate treasury management for virtually all my career, and I think it's only really in the last 10 years that people have begun to think in the sort of very definite terms they have about the usefulness of these markets. Although it's worth saying that in London, what I call the daddy of the derivative market, which is the London Foreign Exchange market, has been in existence for, of course, a great many years. And as Paul pointed out, the opportunity to use forward exchange contracts and so on and so forth is an extremely important element of international companies' ability to hedge and manage their risks relating to international trade. I think a second thing that I might just dwell on in commenting on Paul's very interesting talk is that there are a number of motives for using these markets. The first is risk management, hedging, if you like, although it may not always be hedging. It may be taking an open position for a reason which is particular to the circumstances of the hedger. The second motive is trading. A great many people who trade on exchanges or who deal on exchanges are actually concerned with the opportunities afforded by them through trading, through arbitrage, and so on and so forth. There is, frankly, and all markets have this element, a speculative element. No successful derivative or cash market can operate without speculators. And then one interesting one, which is particularly relevant to the use of derivatives, and particularly futures in relation to equity products, is what's called strategic allocation. You can, in effect, by buying a FTSE, the FTSE 100 index, a FTSE future, take a position in the equity market and then follow it up with cash purchases and liquidate your future position. So if you think that the FTSE is going to increase in value in the cash market, you can actually anticipate that by going out into the future market and do it much more simply and do it like that rather than having to liquidate a portfolio. I think it's also worth saying that derivatives in general terms will only operate where there is a strong cash market. There are relatively few examples, none that I can really think of, although maybe colleagues here can correct me on this, relatively few examples of a successful derivative market without a strong cash market. And the two things feed on each other, particularly Paul referred to bond products. Perhaps the most successful bond product in the world is the US T-bond, which is a massive contract, and there's clearly a very strong T-bond contract. It's got a cash market as well as a strong derivative contract. One other point I'd like to make is that an important element of derivative markets are options. Futures are concerned with the obligation to buy and sell in the future. Options are concerned with the right, but not the obligation. And this gives you a little more flexibility in terms of planning, and certainly in mathematical terms, those of you who are interested in the mathematical aspect of this will know that the rocket science which has been poured into understanding and calculating what option premiums ought to be and so on and so forth is very, very sophisticated indeed. And although I claim to have a mathematical background, I must say it's left me a long way behind. So far as the markets themselves are concerned, Paul referred principally to exchange markets. I alluded in my opening remarks to over-the-counter markets. There are two marketplaces. One are products, contracts, futures arrangements, which are traded on exchanges. But a very significant, probably the preponderant element of the market in derivatives, is actually on the basis of over-the-counter, which means that someone who wishes to take a position in the future, right, or be the beneficiary in option or whatever it is, will go along to a financial institution, and the financial institution will in effect do some kind of a derivative deal with them on a specially tailored basis. And perhaps the most obvious example of an over-the-counter market is the London Foreign Exchange market, which is not traded on exchange. It is a bilateral market, and it is incredibly liquid. I mean, the fact is that Life many years ago thought that it would be a good idea to try to get into the foreign exchange market, because the foreign exchange market, as I say, is the daddy of all derivative markets. And we can never do that because the local bilateral over-the-counter market was so liquid, and the difference between buying and selling in that market was so small. So that's the over-the-counter market, very important. When you hear people commentate in the press or on the radio, on television, about the systemic risk in derivatives, I think that they probably allude very much more to the over-the-counter market than they do to the on-exchange market. The on-exchange market, the risks in it are controlled quite closely. They're controlled principally through a system of margining, which means that if you take a position and you don't trade it out, don't close it out of an open position, what you are expected to do, what you are obligated to do, is to place a form of margin, a percentage of the open position with the person you deal with in the marketplace, and then that person will place it with the clearinghouse. The clearinghouse is the entity which stands between the two sides of the deal. Paul referred to the fact that there is, you don't have to worry about your counterparty risk. That's true, it's taken up by the clearinghouse, but the clearinghouse expects to receive margin. And it's in that way that exchanges manage their risk, and I think they do it quite successfully. What the regulators are concerned about is the fact that the over-the-counter derivative market does not have this method of margining, of risk management. It is, in effect, an unsecured open risk. And when you see people talk about systemic risk, that is principally what they refer to. Paul alluded to the importance of risk management. I would say that this is never more important in terms of the use of derivative markets, whether they be on exchange or off exchange, than that which relates to my own background, which is corporate treasury, where the principal role of the treasurer is really can be divided into two parts. The first part is to identify the risk, and the second part is how to manage it, and all the tools relating to the management of financial risk, so far as the corporate treasurer are concerned, are contained within the derivative opportunities which are available to him, be they on exchange or over the counter. One particular thing which I think is quite interesting and an opportunity in derivative terms is something which is increasingly happening in the equity market. There are strategies which are not particularly risky, which are being increasingly adopted by fund managers using equity derivatives, which involve enhancing yield. This is particularly true in relation to pension fund management, although pension funds in this country are relatively slow into the field. But it is possible, and those of you who study pension funds will know how actuarially important this is, it is possible relatively safely through the use of derivatives and principally options to improve the yield on equity portfolios by, say, 0.5%. Now, 0.5% doesn't sound very much, but I can tell you when you're managing a very, very large pension fund, it's a very significant opportunity. So I mention that because I think that is part and parcel of a specific point, and perhaps adding to the points you made in relation to yield enhancement that you referred to, Paul. And then just one final thing I want to say, and I say this with the due deference because I've only just arrived in life. Life is a very innovative place, and you talked about catastrophe futures, and of course we don't like to be too far behind America, not least because we have something of a shambles, frankly, in the Lloyd's market here, and it's very doubtful that the capacity that Lloyd's used to enjoy through its traditional way of dealing with insurance will be there in the future. And so Life, in conjunction with a couple of insurance brokers, is looking at the opportunity itself of introducing some kind of catastrophe insurance future. It would be, as in America, I think what's called windstorm damage. But the difficulty we're finding at the moment, and this is the problem I suspect in Chicago too, is that whilst there is a great deal of interest from the point of view of those who wish to reinsure the risk in using the market, it's a question of finding people who will come into the market who will accept the risk. And so there's a big educational process which to go on there. I think that some of the people who came into the market thinking that they were relatively rich and thinking this was an opportunity to make money for old rope in Lloyd's would find it very much more difficult if they understood what the insurance market was like in the first place to understand the sort of risks associated with this particular product. But we are there, and I think that's a particularly interesting one. And many people believe that it could be one of the most important contracts for the future. So maybe 10 years from now, if I happen to be lucky enough to be talking to you again, I may be saying, I told you so, this was going to be one of the most exciting products that we could be offering on the exchange. I'm afraid this is rather anecdotal and rambling, but I hope that that's given you some thoughts and additions to what Paul said. And Paul made things very precise and so on, so I'm really adding where I thought I could add something.
views expressed in these audio tapes are those of the speakers and not of the Institute, which has no corporate view. The Institute's publications seek to further its objectives of promoting the advancement of learning by research into economic and political science, by education of the public through that research, and by the dissemination of ideas.